When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And welcome to Ladies Who London podcast. I'm Emily Dell.
And I'm Alex Lacey, and we're qualified London Blue Badge tourist guides.
Each week we bring to you some of the best bits of London.
We talk about our favourite people, places and events with a bit of information, a lot of laughs and a whole lot of fun.
We can be found on Instagram at Ladies Who London podcast. And on our websites. Sorry. And on our websites. At God, what the hell am I doing?
GuideEmily.com and AlexLacey.com for information about our upcoming walking tours and virtual tours, as well as what the Blue Badge guiding qualification is all about.
Seriously? Oh, dear.
And that was with it in front of us. Oh, we're useless. Absolutely useless podcasters. Anyway, hello, everybody.
Hello, everybody.
Welcome back to this competitive sweating competition.
Oh, gosh, isn't it?
It is.
How are we doing? Are we keeping cool out there? Probably not.
We're 90% melted at this end.
Have you got your paddling pool up?
Paddling pool is up, yes.
Good,
and
you found
when we finish
it.
This, I'm getting into it. I'm staying there for a week.
Are you wearing your swimming costume
yes!
now? Can you give it a little twang so people know that you're wearing Lycra?
I'm in my swimmers, yeah.
Wow. Fantastic.
It's just so hot. I would be naked, except I know that you probably wouldn't appreciate that.
Hey, look, I mean, go for it. I thought you were literally, you put your hands behind your back then, as if you were like about to.
I'm just going to strip off now.
Reveal.
It is roasting in the UK. Goodness me. How are you dealing with it?
Yeah, all right. I'm fine because I absolutely adore the heat. It's just trying to keep calm and cool. We've got quite a big fan and she's just been in a nappy most of the time. But hat.
Goodness, I am not made for the heat. I am, you know, I am a stocky Anglo-Saxon. I am not made for high temperatures. Anyway, well, welcome back, everybody. Lovely to have you back with us this week. It's been a busy week. I've been away. What have you been up to?
I had a tour on Saturday.
Did
I was
you?
Out and about.
Woo!
Yes, I did a 2-hour tour along the South Bank, which was
amazing.
Really nice. Super busy, super sweaty, but yeah, lovely to get out for a little bit.
Oh, fantastic! I've toured the last 2 days, and you just sweat, and I'm sort of just not even going to apologise for it anymore.
I can't
do anything else. I'm just going to stand here and sweat. It is one of my superpowers, to be fair.
It's a very good superpower to have.
Very good superpower.
As long as there's not a scent with it, you can sweat.
Oh, that's why they were standing far away.
Oh, was that it? Sort yourself out, Alex Lacey.
Yeah, I know, right? I know. Anyway, on with the podcast. So this week, well, last week, we need to just tidy up last week's episode, which was all about, Emily?
Last week, we spoke about...
The Festival of Britain.
The Festival of Britain.
I thought it was your week.
I was trying to like sing that out to try and make my mind jog quickly.
I can see your eyes just going, Festival of Britain.
Festival of Britain.
We picked our favourite kind of crux points or important bits of it for you to vote on, which was your favourite for the podcast pedestal. And we had, my option was the Skylon, which was this kind of crazy alien looking sculpture sort of hanging over the South Bank, which frankly, I reckon should have stayed. And that was my pick. What was your pick?
My pick was the steel drum band. So basically the first time that Britons heard the sound of steel drums was at the Festival of Britain. And fantastic. It was a band from Trinidad. So, yeah.
I love it. Especially when we're talking about, you know, the Windrush generation of that time. So it was really lovely to kind of include some of the people who were coming in. That's fantastic. Great choice. It's very close this week. We've gone back to a close one.
Yes, well, mine was super close. So
was mine. I think mine was close, the same amount of votes that yours was close as well.
Really? On your side?
Yes.
Oh, all right.
Yes. Yeah. And it was 48 to 52 in the end.
48 to 52.
48% to 52%. Very Brexity.
I'm guessing by your eyebrows, I have lost this week.
Are you?
Oh.
You have not. You've won.
You're kidding me.
Yes.
Have I? Wow.
Steel drum band won it this week.
Oh, my God. Da-la-la-long, da-la-la-long.
Oh, dear. I knew something like that. She'd do something, some crazy music version of it. Wonderful. So there you go. You've won.
Brilliant. So what is it now? 21 to 20?
21 to 20,
I think. We were both on 20, weren't we?
I think we were because you messed up the numbers a bit last week.
It's not surprising, is it?
It's hilarious.
Oh, gosh. Oh, thank you, everybody. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you for voting for me too, even if we didn't quite make it. Another push next week, chaps. Let's do it. Yeah.
Well, so what are we talking about this week, Alex Lacey?
Well, we spun the wheel last week and it landed in Bloomsbury, which is quite cool because we haven't done Bloomsbury for a while. I'm trying to think.
Oh.
Well, you had Virginia Woolf a few weeks back, didn't you?
Oh, that was quite a while back.
But I'm not sure if we've had Bloomsbury before.
I'm pretty sure we've had it a couple of times.
Maybe. Well, anyway,
we're here
again. I have decided that I wanted to talk about a really interesting woman, a lady called Noor Inayat Khan. And her story, now, when I picked her, I knew a bit about her and I found out more and it's really cool. She is an absolute legend. So the reason I picked Bloomsbury is because she lived there with her family and there is a plaque and a sculpture to her. We're going to come to that a little bit later on because there's some really interesting stuff around both of those. But to go back to the start, who is she? Well, really interestingly, and I don't know why I find this quite so interesting, but Noor's dates, her when she was born and when she died, are both in the middle of a war. She was born on New Year's Day in 1914. So actually, the war wouldn't quite have started then. But still, you know, it's in the year of a war. And she died in 1944. Now, Noor, as you might tell from the name, Noor Inayat Khan has Indian heritage. Her father was Indian and her mother was a white American woman. And I love the name that they gave her. Her full name is beautiful. It's Noor Unnisa Inayat Khan. And it means the light of womanhood.
Oh, I love that.
It's amazing. What does your name mean?
I don't know. Do you know what your name means?
Alexandra, it means hilariously defender of men.
That is ridiculous.
I know. They don't need no defending. I'm all good.
Defender of men.
Yeah.
Wow.
Anyway, but hey. Now, she was born in Moscow. Just outside the Kremlin, actually. Hmm. And the family moved to England very, very shortly after World War I broke out. So as you can tell, it's the same year that she's born. So she's only a couple of months old. And they move over to England. And her father is quite interesting. He's a musician and he's a Sufi teacher. Do you know what Sufi is?
Sufi? Oh, I have heard of this.
It's a type of Islam. It's a kind of from what I've been reading about, it's sort of a mystical form. It's quite pious, but it's about sort of mysticism and all this kind of thing. So when war breaks out in 1914, he decides that London is the place to come. So he moves over, brings the whole family over, and you know they're okay there for a few years, but he is very, very pro-India. And pro-Indian self-rule. Now, of course, we're talking early 1900s. We've got Churchill, who is... later Churchill will be on. But the thought about Indian self-rule, you know, we're just off the back of the Victorian period, which is all about the empire. And it's not, you know, this is not a view that the British government like. But there's an extra added bit to this because they are royal. They are related, descended from a chap called Tipu Sultan.
Oh, I've heard of Tipu Sultan. Is this the connected to the tiger in the V&A?
Absolutely, the same guy. So Tipu Sultan is her great-great-great-grandfather. I think I've got the right number of greats in there. And he was somebody who massively fought the British in India when they were over there, you know, colonising and all of that kind of thing. And he died in 1799 fighting the British. So you can imagine that having descended from Tipu Sultan, this makes Noor, firstly, she makes her a princess, but you can imagine that their take on Indian self-rule is pretty rigid and is pretty pro-India. Mm-hmm. So this is not something that the British government are particularly keen on. Churchill famously later in the Second World War, he is very anti-Indian self-rule, and as are a lot of politicians. So what they find is that bit by bit, they seem to be being surveilled by the British more and more and more. So in the end, her father decides, right, stuff it, we're going to go to Paris. So in 1920, after the end of the First World War, he upsticks, takes the family and moves them over to Paris. And so by this point, Noor is six, mm-hmm. and she lives there with, she's got three younger siblings by this point, who've all been born in the UK, and they live in Paris all together. And she lives there until she's 26 years of age. So bear in mind, she's grown up there, essentially, for the most part of her formative years. She speaks fluent French. Now, this is going to be very key in a little bit. Okay. So what Noor does is something happens in 1927, which really kind of shapes her childhood. Her father decides he's going to go back to India. He'd not been very well, and he was really feeling this pull to go back to his homeland. And the family kind of knew that he wouldn't be coming back. They sort of, you know, they kind of figured it. And a few months later, they got the news that he'd actually died. Now, Noor is only 13 at this point. Gosh. And her mother does not take this very well. Her mother goes, just basically shuts down. And doesn't really want to see anybody. She kind of goes into seclusion and she's not going to come down and meet anybody who comes to the house or anything. So Noor, being the oldest sibling, she's 13 years of age, she has to start mothering her three siblings who are all younger. So this is quite an interesting development because it really, you know, she is forced to take this role on, mm-hmm. and it makes her very, very organized and very independent, and really also she's very, very interested in child welfare too. Now eventually she kind of, her mum, after quite a significant amount of time, she manages to get her mum to come around. Now her mum was, as I mentioned, a white American woman who, when she'd married Noor's father, had changed her name and had taken the name Amima Begum.
Okay.
And she wore Muslim dress and outfit, but after her father died and Noor kind of eventually coaxed her out, she went back to wearing Western dress. There's this quite interesting sort of juxtaposition going on in Noor's life as well.
Yeah, there's quite a few culture fusions, isn't there?
Absolutely. Which I think is what's going to stand her in good stead when we come to the crux of the story later. So, apart from her father dying, you know, everything's fairly normal in Paris. They would dress in their Indian clothes and give concerts for guests, because like I say, her father was a musician and they were all really, really musically talented, and the four of them formed a quartet, so they were playing, you know, music to people who would come and, you know, friends who'd come and listen. But obviously this thing of having to take on this role as mother to her siblings was had sort of bared on her quite heavily. So she goes to the Sorbonne, of all places, this amazing, mm-hmm. you know, the Ivy League of France, and she studies child psychology.
Oh, wow.
Right. So you can see where all this has come from. And
I'm guessing at that time you would have needed quite a lot of money to get in there.
Now, do you know what? I don't know about that. I have to say, I'm not sure. I would suspect so. But I don't know anything about their financial situation. It's an interesting question.
Okay.
Interesting. Might have to do a bit of digging. Also joined another school to study music. So, you know, all of this is
kind of linked. Lots going on.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Now, when she's at this school, she meets and again, rather crucially, a Jewish musician. And she sort of, they end up dating, and she kind of becomes engaged to him, although it's not really, not kind of formalised. But now, how would you imagine her family would take this?
I think they'd be a little bit dubious.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact,
they'd be a little bit worried.
They kind of disapproved in quite a big way, actually. And this really was a problem for her because she didn't quite know. She felt quite divided between her family and her fiancé. So, you know, but bear in mind that he is a Jewish musician. That's going to come back again. So all of these things are kind of, put them all in the pot. Give them a bit of stir, and later you're going to see where all of this kind of comes together.
I feel like we're going to have quite a few crux points to
we might
about later for our podcast.
We
pedestal.
Might. I'm setting them up. We might have to have a 7 or 8. She goes on, quite interestingly, to write children's stories. And she writes a ton of them. She contributes to French radio and magazines. She gets published in the Sunday section of a very famous French newspaper, which is still around today, called Le Figaro.
Oh.
Yeah, I know. So she's doing, this is incredible stuff. She also publishes a book, which is a collection of sort of Buddhist-based kind of fables and things like that.
Okay.
And this gets published in both France and the UK. So she's doing, you know, really quite well.
And I guess that she's got this kind of, because she's looking after her siblings, she has to earn some money. She's got to look after them.
Yeah. And by this point, they would have been a bit older, so they'd probably be going out to work and study and all that, that kind of thing as well. By this point, she's about 26-ish, maybe, something like that. So it all changes when we get to 1940. Now, of course, she's living in Paris. What's going to happen in Paris in 1940? It's going to fall to the Nazis. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that's Noor has really this is a sort of a tenet that her father has given her through all of his Sufi teaching and belief, that they've got this very staunch non-violence sort of belief within them, and also the fact that all religions can kind of exist alongside each other. So she's come from this very sort of tolerant background, and she, you know, fighting against sort of fascism and occupation and all this kind of stuff, but they are staunch pacifists. So she is kind of thinking, like, you know, this, what they're doing, coming across Europe, persecuting the Jewish and taking over other countries, I'm not okay with this, but I'm also a pacifist. So when they come to London, she and her brother was called Villiat, they decided that they opposed all of what the Nazis were doing, but, and they were also staunch pacifists, but they felt that they were kind of morally, I guess, morally obliged to take a more active role, but very crucially, one that is not going to involve taking a life or killing somebody.
Okay, yeah.
So this is quite an interesting, you know, thought of where are you going to go from here?
Yeah, what are they going to do?
So, of course, if you think about it, she is Muslim. Mm-hmm. She's been sort of engaged to this Jewish guy.
Yeah.
So she has got this urge that she needs to do something as well. So when Villiat signs up, and I can't remember exactly what he goes into, Noor thinks, I need to do the same. And she was a really, really sort of, she was so pushed to do this that she went up to the Women's Auxiliary Air Force, or the WAF, okay? And she said to them, look, I want to sign up. I want to be part of this. I want to be doing something to help. And what's really hilarious is she had this interview with them to figure out, you know, if she's the right kind of person, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And during this interview, she says to them, look, I am massively pro Indian self-rule. I am very against what the British are doing in India. Mm-hmm. And they were like, oh, okay. And she said, look, when the war's over, I'm probably going to be supporting India against Britain.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, hang on. So we've got this person who is willing to sort of come in and fight
on our side, but it's going to be against us soon after.
This is what's so interesting about her, is that she has this massive mix of cultures, but she's also got this really strong sense of, I'm going to do what's right.
Yeah. And I guess I'm not right, allied to right any
particular,
now.
Exactly. I'm not allied to any particular side, you know, till the end. I am going to go for what's right and I'm going to fight for that.
Mm. And I love that she told them that because she didn't necessarily yes. need to.
No.
But she just wanted to make sure that they knew where she was at.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow, I really respect that.
And, you know, they were a bit like, oh, is she... There was a little bit of... A few people were dubious about whether...
Can we trust her?
Exactly.
Yeah. Is she, you know, she's not fully on our side. She might be right now, but there's a part of her mind and her heart that isn't.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that she is quite interesting is that she was... She believed that the more people of Indian heritage who signed up for the war and did their bit and helped out... that the more that this was going to heal the rift between
course,
the countries.
Of course,
she
yes.
is a she is a really strategic thinker on all these things. It's fantastic. It's one of the reasons I absolutely love her. So, she signs up to the WAF in 1940 in November. Now, she's only just arrived in the UK. She moves over in 1940 and almost immediately she signed up to them and they, you know, and they take her on. Now, she's busy kind of training away and she's training as a radio operator. And into all of this comes the SOE, the Special Operations Executive. Basically, these guys are the spies. Oh. And they are looking for the right kind of person to come and be a spy for them. And they spot her. And she is excelling at all of her training. She's amazing. She's doing everything that, you know, perfectly and mm-hmm. is clearly driven and all this.
Absolutely smashing it.
Plus, what's the other thing that really helps out? She speaks fluent French.
Oh, yes. Hmm. She's got so many strings to her bow, this one, hasn't she?
So many, so many. And so they approach her and they say, look, this is what we've got. This is what we want you to come and do. We want you to go and be a radio operator in France. Mm-hmm. So occupied France. Now, they were very honest with her and they said, look, it's a very, very dangerous job. The pay is terrible as well. And she was like, yep, sign me up, don't care. She just goes for it. She's like, yes, okay.
Wow.
And I mean, I say it's a dangerous job. It really was. Firstly, you've got this radio tech that you've got to carry around with you, which costs, which weighs about 20 pounds. So it's not light. It's quite bulky. It's very hard to conceal. If you stay on air more than about 15 or 20 minutes, then the enemy are going to detect you.
Oh.
And the average lifespan, how long would you reckon would be the average lifespan of a field agent doing that job?
I would say a couple of weeks.
Yeah, 6 weeks.
Oh, my God.
6 weeks is the average lifespan of a field agent once they've gone into occupied territory. So it's massively dangerous. But she decided to do it.
And yet, so, yes, she knows that. She's been told, you know, I wonder if they said that, you know, most people have about 6 weeks.
Yeah. And I think she would have been. Yeah, because they, you know, they were very they're very honest with all of their staff, all of their agents, all their spies. They're, you know, you're not going to sort of hide that from people, are you?
No.
So one morning in 1942, so she signed up in 1940, and this is 2 years later, she's gone through her training and all this kind of thing. Her colleagues in the WAF, so the Women's Air Auxiliary Force, just woke up one morning and found that she'd disappeared. There was no note. There was no kind of, I'm going here, write to me here. There was a folded blanket on her bed and she'd gone for her career in the Secret Service.
Wow.
Just
and that, of course she couldn't tell anybody. So it was like, off she goes.
Exactly. So she went into her training as a secret agent. They taught her how to live with a false identity and be able to transmit your radio signal in secret and to kind of, you know, avoid detection. And she, it was kind of, I mean, it's exactly what you'd imagine a spy school would be. She is being taught to fire guns and put explosives and break locks and you know, kill people. I mean, obviously that's not something she wanted ever to do, but she's got to have that training anyway. And sending coded things and Morse code, like all of this stuff.
And I guess it would have been really quick as well. Like the training would have been fast and heavy because obviously they haven't got that much time.
Well, actually, no, it's about a year. It's about a year before she goes.
Oh.
So well, actually, I don't know exactly how long it was. It was in 1942 that she started it, and she went over in June 1943. So at least half a year, but probably, you know, somewhere between half a year and a year. Because, you know, this is something that if you're average lifespan is 6 weeks, and that's with all the training. You're going to make sure you train these people up as much as you
possible. Oh, yes, definitely.
She's also one of the things, I love this, it's kind of, they're taught about how, what life is like in occupied France, and they're also shown loads of pictures of the enemy so that you can kind of spot them from their, you know, from their uniforms and stuff like that, which is hilarious. So anyway, she goes out on June the 16th of 1943, and she is flown, well, she's taken firstly to an airfield, and then she has all of, everything's checked. So her pockets are all checked, because you want to make sure that she's got no English things in there that could give her away, like train tickets or, you know, anything like that. She's given a false passport. She's given some French francs.
Right.
Her gun. Oh. And then she's also got the cyanide pills as well.
Oh.
Which is the thing, if you're captured, you use that. Right?
Yes.
Now, she's then flown over to France. And when she's flown over...
Can I just ask a question?
Yeah.
With the cyanide pills, how long until they take over?
Oh, they're very quick.
Really quick.
Yeah, you bite them and then they're very quick.
Really?
You've not seen James Bond?
Yes, but... but you never know exactly how quick. Like, is it literally like...
I think minutes.
Minutes? Yeah. Wow.
And I am going to preface this by saying she doesn't use the cyanide pills.
Okay,
don't
good.
Get too caught up on them. Good. Just use them.
Okay, that's not a crux point.
That's not a crux point, no. Just an interesting little fact that's what she had with her. Anyway, okay. So she goes over to France. When she goes to France, this is where, you know, again, we get this sense of Noor just being like, I'm doing it.
Mm.
She is not only the first female wireless operator to be sent to the country by the UK, she is also the first female agent to be parachuted behind enemy lines. Yeah.
How she suddenly got to this point, and quite quickly, it seems.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Now, there'd been women who'd gone there before, but they'd been couriers, so not the same thing and this kind of thing. So anyway.
She must have had such a strong personality, you know, for people really trust her and know that she's going to do a good job. She must have walked into a room and really owned it.
Yeah, and from reading a little bit about what people said about her, she seemed to be very sort of... She had quite a calming presence, which I think is rather lovely, because she's got this... Obviously, she's so innately sure in who she is and what she wants to achieve that there's a calmness that comes with that, isn't there?
Yeah, probably like a cool head. Yeah.
And just a sort of sense of purpose and a sense of being.
Can handle pressure.
Definitely. Clearly, I mean. She lands in France, and then she travels to Paris. And one of the things that she's going to do, well, the main thing she's going to do, is she's going to link up with the French Resistance Network. Now, there's a whole variety of different networks that are all part of the Resistance. And the one in this area is called Prosper. And it's one of the major big resistance networks. So she gets there. Within a week, all of the major members of Prosper, particularly the agents, are captured by the Nazis. And all
within
of their work within a week of her being there. Now, not her. She evades capture, which is amazing. Basically, what had happened is the resistance had been infiltrated by tons of double agents, and they had no idea that was the case and quite how deeply they were embedded in the resistance network. So that's what happened. But Noor, amazingly, doesn't get arrested. It may be that she was new and, you know, she hadn't kind of appeared on the Nazi list quite so much. But realistically, the network would have known who she was anyway. So she's given the codename Madeline, I should say, as well. Codename Madeline. So that's what she's known as. And nobody, in fact, I don't think even the Germans know her as Noor Khan, Noor Eniac Khan. They know her as Nora Brown, I think.
Okay.
When they finally get to it, but you know, that's not really her name. That's a sort of a bit of a mix of her mother's name and her name. So, you know, still not hers.
Yeah.
So when everyone's arrested, Noor is told, look, go into hiding, just lie low. And with another SOE agent, so the special operations agent, she really lies low and she starts gathering information about who's betrayed them and who else is being arrested and all this sort of stuff. Now, London contacted her and said, come back. It is too dangerous. Don't, you know, the network's gone. You're in serious peril. Come back to the UK. And Nora's like, no, I've got a job to do. I'm staying here.
Oh gosh.
Yeah.
This needs to be made into a film if it hasn't.
Do you know
already
what?
Been.
It really does. And it, yeah, we'll come on to that.
Oh gosh, you can just imagine it, can't you? They're on the phone to her saying, come back, abort, abort.
Yeah.
And she's like, no, puts the foot down, just carries on.
Because as well as, you know, being who she is and having this sort of very you know, this sense of this is who I is what I need to do, she is also the only British agent left in Paris. So she knows if she's not going to do it, no one else is going to do it.
No one else will.
No.
She is the last thread.
She's the last radio link. And so she says, look, I'm going to stay here. I'm going to keep doing it. And she takes on basically the work of six different radio operators. And she is now the Germans clock on very quickly to her. They know exactly who she is. Well, you know, not exactly who she is, but they know that they're after her. They could even hear the transmissions that she was making, but they couldn't catch her. She took her wireless, this massive sort of £20 bulky wireless kit with her everywhere, in a suitcase. And she's quite small. She's quite slight. So it's a lot to carry with her. And she has quite a few narrow escapes. There's one occasion where she's stopped on the metro system in Paris, and these German officers question, and they say, what's in your suitcase? And she has to open it up, and they say, you know, what is this? And she says, well, it's a cinema thing.
For
cinematography. I mean, look, you can see that. Look at the light bulbs. This is what happens. And the German soldiers didn't know any better, so they let her go.
Oh my God, pounding heart. Wow.
Absolutely. Wow. And there was another occasion where she was apparently hanging out of a window to try and, you know, send these radio transmissions. And a German officer who lived in the building saw her doing this and came in and said, you know, what are you doing? And she said something like, oh, I'm trying to get, you know, radio reception for listening to radio or something like that. And he helped her put the aerial in place.
No.
Yes. I mean, she is quick.
Wow.
Whatever she's, you know, she's just going, oh, yeah, cool, it's this. And they're taking it. They're absolutely taking it. So they really come really quite close to her on a few occasions. And what a lot of her messages do are they're really, really helpful for setting the ground for the success of D-Day, which will be in 1944.
Okay.
So this is incredibly important. Now, there's a few... there was a chap who spoke to the Guardian newspaper a while ago, a guy called Arthur Majida, and he was writing a book on Noor. And he said that he had managed to get an account by another French resistance fighter, a chap called Pierre Vianon. And he'd written a kind of memoir, but it wasn't published. It was for his family. And so he managed to get hold of this. And it sheds a little bit of light on what's going on in 1943. So that the Nazis, the Gestapo, are kind of, they're closing in, you know. And the rest of the resistance are doing everything they can to keep her from being detected. They take her to this place where she can get a whole new wardrobe, except everything she's chosen is blue. She loves the colour blue, and the Gestapo knows this. And apparently he reckons that this was quite a key factor in eventually giving her away, because they knew what they didn't know what she looked like, but blue was the colour that they were kind of looking out for.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And he also said,
I guess, I mean, were other people not really wearing blue at the time?
I don't know, but it seems that she wanted her kind of whole wardrobe to be blue. So you just,
so
you know, she's
always
wearing blue.
You always saw her in blue.
Absolutely. He also said that he'd been working with her for a few weeks, and she was absolutely exhausted. They went to a cafe, and he said, look, she couldn't even sit up. And he said, look, let's go to a local hotel. We're going to pretend that we're lovers. We're going to ask for a room. And he said they got this room, and she just collapsed on the bed and just slept. And then a couple of hours later, she woke up, and then they started work.
I'm not surprised. I mean, the stress and the anxiety, because, you know, she might have been good under pressure and had a cool head, but, you know, come on, she's human.
She's doing the work of six radio operators.
Scared. Yeah.
So she's going to be busy and exhausted and running and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
And like, just carrying the box round.
Yeah. Exactly. So now this ends the way that you probably think it's going to end. She is betrayed by a female colleague.
Oh!
And she's arrested by the Gestapo. Apparently this colleague sold her address to the Gestapo for 100,000 francs, which is a lot of money.
Whoa.
Yeah, absolutely.
I wonder if she actually got it.
Who knows? Who knows? Who knows? So Noor is arrested and she's taken to Germany. Now, what's slightly unwise is she has kept copies of all of her these signals that she's been sending.
Oh, God.
And the Germans used the radio and sort of the format of what she'd been using to trick London to sending new agents who were then immediately arrested. Now, I love that also Noor does not take being locked up lying down. She escapes twice. Yeah. The first one, she escapes and is captured a few hours later. And the second one, which sounds like a really quite amazing attempt, she gets out through the sky window in the place she's being kept with two other people. And they kind of start, they get out and they start kind of climbing across the roof. And then typically the RAF start bombing as they're on the roof.
You can just imagine it. Like, as I say, this really needs to be a film.
Oh my goodness, really does.
Cue the James Bond theme tune.
Right? I mean, this is the thing. This is a real life spy who is just incredible. So when the RAF start bombing, the sirens go off and the Germans find the, you know, search the rooms and find them on the roof. So, you know. And they try to get her to, this is the best bit, they try to get her to sign an agreement to say that she's not going to try and escape again. And she's like, I'm not going to sign that. And she refuses to sign it.
Oh, good for her.
Which is hilarious. So she is treated as a very high level, quite dangerous prisoner to them. She's taken off to a prison in Germany. This is about November of 1943. So, you know, knocking on. She's been captured in November. She's taken off to Germany and she's kept in, this is where it gets really awful. She's kept in solitary confinement, and because she's considered to be such a threat and such a dangerous prisoner, and she's also shackled in chains and foot irons.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's really, really not very pleasant at all.
And do you think they know this back in Britain?
Oh, I'm sure that they would have known that she was captured, whether or not they'd known where she's gone. I mean, that I don't know. Mm. Now, this is, you know, she still kind of carries on. She's not going to be cowed by the fact that she's in a very high security prison in Germany in leg irons. She starts communicating with the other prisoners, the other female prisoners in the other cells, by scratching messages on her food bowl.
Oh,
which
my
is really quite
me.
Amazing. And the messages
just with
are sort
her
of,
cutlery or
with
her
what
nails?
I don't know what she was scratching with, whatever really, you know, anything sharp you can find. Mm. And they basically pass messages back and forth. Now the other women are in cells where they can hear the RAF planes flying overhead. So they're giving her updates on the progress of the war and all this kind of thing. And she is at this prison for about 10 months. Now it gets to September of 1944. And by this point, 1944, we will have had D-Day. Mm. So the Allies are approaching. The Germans are, sorry, I shouldn't say Germans, the Nazis are on, you know, they're probably panicking quite a little bit, you know. I made a side that she and three other of the SOE agents are going to be transferred to Dachau concentration camp.
God.
Which is where they go. On the 13th of September. Now, she's been all this time, she's been being tortured at the prison. She has not given away any information. Nothing at all. Mm. She's not broken. She has not given away any of the link, the chain of people. She's not given away a thing. So they're keeping, you know, they're keeping her in the hope that she might. But clearly, she's not
going to
do it.
She's not going to. No, hugely loyal.
And when they get to Dachau, she's pulled away from the other women, this other three women, and she is tortured again. You know, really quite badly. And she's tortured all night long, and she's kind of kicked and beaten and everything. And eventually, when she can't take any more, they shoot her.
Oh my God.
Yeah, they execute her. Not execute her in the way that they did, you know, lining people up against the wall or anything. They just shot her. Just shot her right there.
Oh, and her they just knew they were never going to get the information out, you know, out of her.
And they're probably, by this point, September 44, they're probably getting a little bit desperate. I mean, they're also thinking that the Brits and, you know, or the Allies are not going to get as far as this and find all of these concentration camps and stuff, which, of course, as we know, is wrong. But they've got the willies a little bit. You know, they're freaking out. It is said that her last reported word was liberté.
Wow.
It's amazing. Now, that night that she was murdered, her mother and her brother were back in London and they had the same dream. nor came to them. She was surrounded by blue light and she said,
oh my god,
free.
I've literally got chills.
I know.
Oh
yeah, so she said, she tells them that she's free. I know, it gives me goosebumps.
And honestly, incredible. That just like this wave just went over me then.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Now so if you remember, her code name was Madeleine.
Mm.
And in France, because of course she was French, essentially, you know, she grew up there. She might not have been born there, but she, you know, she grew up in France and she was, to all intents and purposes, French. She is remembered very heavily as a heroine of the resistance. Mm. There is a plaque outside the family home that they used to live in. And every year on Bastille Day, a band plays outside her house.
Oh, that's lovely. Beautiful. There's, I love that.
There's a square in that same town called the Cour Madeleine after her. And, you know, she's been really hailed as, well, yeah. In fact, they have called her, the mayor of Paris, I think it was, called her the modern Joan of Arc, which is rather interesting.
Gosh.
But she was slightly less rewarded in the UK. She did get, she was only one of three women from the SOE to be awarded the George Cross. Now, the George Cross, if you don't know, is the highest military honour that can be given to people essentially who die for the military. The other two, there's Violette Sabo and Odette Hallows. Now they're better known. They've actually, talking about films, they have had films made about their lives.
Okay.
Interestingly. Nor has not, and I think she is prime for that story being told. Anyway. So she does get the George Cross, which is, I think, given in 1949, so shortly after the Second World War, and 1946, she also gets the French version of that as well. So, you know, it's called the Croix de Guerre, and that's awarded literally straight after the war. But apart from that, she's then kind of forgotten in the UK, or clearly not in France. She's very much not. But her story, and this is, I think it's so sad that we are very quick to forget women like this. You know, she is the first Muslim woman to be going, or you know, or woman even, to be going into Allied territory as a spy. You know, it's very, very, she's a very big deal. There's a lady called Shrabani Basu, and she decided that she was going to write the biography of Nora. I think the book is called Spy Princess. She wrote this in 2006, and at this point everyone's like, oh my goodness, who is this woman? This is incredible.
Yeah,
because her story had just been forgotten. And Shrabani, along with a variety of other people, set up a sort of organization to campaign for a sculpture of her.
Ooh.
And that sculpture was put in place in 2012. Princess Anne unveiled it with Shrabani, who was there as well. And in fact, even the statue was a bit problematic. So they spent years raising money for the statue, and they did kind of concerts with famous indie musicians like Anusha Shankar played as well.
Oh wow!
And there was massive support in the government. Actually, there was early day motion that was tabled and all this sort of stuff. And people that signed it included Glenda Jackson, who, as we know, is a very prominent woman, and also, you know, very much up for women's rights as well, and all this kind of thing. And it was kind of a cross-party thing. And the University of London said, yep, brilliant, we would love it to be put in Gordon Square near the University of London. And then Camden Council delayed the approval of it.
No.
And this is literally a couple of weeks before it's due to be unveiled. And there was a petition that was put around, and 700 letters of support from all around the world arrived on the desk of Camden Council.
Oh,
and then they were kind of like,
incredible.
Oh, no, it's all fine. It's all fine. It's just going through.
But what was their reasoning? What was Camden's
They just said that it was just going through the same application that all the processes follow. I mean, who knows, that was the party line. Whether or
God,
not there was more to it than that,
the main thing is how many people wrote letters of support.
I know.
That's amazing.
And then it was permission was granted just 3 weeks before it ended up being installed and unveiled, which is amazing.
I've never seen it.
No, it's on Gordon Square. It's a bit tricky to find, but it's really lovely. Actually, it's a really lovely I think it's bronze.
Okay,
making that up. But interestingly, Noor is the first, and up until this point, the only Muslim woman to be honoured with a statue in Britain.
Yes, girl.
Absolutely. And we've talked in the past about, and you know, I talk on my Women of Westminster walk and things like that, that it is, you know, there are very few sculptures of women around. Mm. And in the UK, there are currently more statues of men called John than there are statues of historical women.
That is ridiculous.
I know.
God.
But what's lovely is this story about Noor has been picked up and has really entered the public consciousness, and people love the story of her and just what an amazing woman she was. In 2014, they issued a new series of stamps, and her face was one of the stamps.
Oh, brilliant.
One of the people that was on the stamps.
Yeah.
There's talk that she may appear on British coins at some point.
Oh, this is fantastic. Cool. So, yeah, people are really starting to get to know her story.
Absolutely. And then in 2020, so only last year, in August, they unveiled a blue plaque to her in Bloomsbury, which is where she lived. And again, that was spearheaded by Shravani, who wrote her biography.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's,
and you know, you might be spearheading something here, Alex, you know. You
well,
never know, because you might, some kind of director or something might be listening
very
to this
happy
podcast
to write
and be like,
for a movie.
Yes, we
very
do
happy
need to
do that.
Write a movie.
But I mean, incredible. And just there are so many sort of visual things about her story as well that it's just incredible. And what a woman. I mean, she just obviously had such a sense of purpose and self that she's like, right, I'm going to go and I'm going to do this. And then when I've done that, I'm going to go and do this. And then I'm just going to, you know, I'm going to go and get stuck in with all the stuff that I feel, you know, strongly about. Just, I love that sense of, I'm going to go and do what's right. Amazing woman.
Mm. It just seems like anything that came her way, she just grabbed it with both hands and then some.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I just love this thing of her, of them going, look, it's pretty dangerous. And actually, I should mention, so the average life, you know, life expectancy of one of these people is 6 weeks. She lasted 3 months on her own with nobody else there, no other agents. The resistance has been massively, you know, kind of, well, decimated, really. And she lasts 3 months. Now, that is testament to her, her power and her, you know, I'm trying to think of the right word, but just her ability to...
Determination.
Yeah, determination, I guess. Yeah, what an amazing woman.
Yeah, gosh. And to be tortured so viciously, it seems. Yeah.
Over the course of almost a year.
Not letting that information... Oh, God, yeah. I guess she knows, you know, I've come this far. I've gone through so much. I'll be damned if I'm going to just suddenly... Oh. Right, Carmen. Just suddenly, you know, give this information away.
Yeah, I mean, just what an amazing woman. What an amazing woman. So there we go. So that is Noor in Ayak Khan.
Wow, I had no idea about her story at all, Alex. That was brilliant. Thank
I knew
you.
The outlines, which is why I wanted to pick her. But I, having done loads of research, I'm just incredible. Absolutely incredible. So you can go and buy. There is the Spy Princess, it's called, is the biography of her by Shravani Bosu. So do go and, you know, do go and buy that. And then there was another chap who wrote a book about her too. But I'd say go for the official biography, really. Yeah.
Mm, fantastic. Thank you very much.
Yay.
Podcast pedestal.
So we need to pick our podcast pedestals, the crux points of this week's story that we think... were really kind of key in her story. So what are you going to go for?
So I think I know. I mean, there are so many, but I think I'm going to go for the fact that she spoke French. I think that was a big old key for her.
Interesting. Okay. Because
that was a huge, you know, way in, wasn't it? Because although she was with the WAF, the fact that she was, she could speak French suddenly got her into a completely different situation. So, yeah, I think I'm going to go for that.
Okay. I'm really torn because there's so many bits that I love about this story. I think, and I don't know how we're going to word this with the limited characters, but I'm going to go for her refusal to come back to London. And to kind of keep going on with that job that she was committed to doing.
Oh, that's a good one. Because, yes, I mean, you get to know so much about her from that decision.
Yeah.
That's great.
It kind of, for me, it says about what she's about. You know, determination, commitment to the cause, and also the knowledge that there's a high chance she ain't going to make it out alive.
Yeah. And yet she's still putting herself
because, you know,
through that.
We saw from her interview, she's got other stuff that she wants to fight for. Realistically, you'd have thought she'd be like, okay, you know what, I'm just going to keep my powder dry, I'm going to come back and live to fight another day. And she's like, no, I'm doing this, I'm here, I'm doing it. So I'm going to go for that, her refusal to come back to London when requested. I don't know how you're going to word that, but we'll figure it out.
Okay. we'll think of something.
There we go. Those are your options. That is a very good everyone.
Ooh, we shall see.
The poll will go up on Sunday on Instagram. You're welcome to drop us an email, ladieswholondon@gmail.com, if you want to vote, or you can just write a note on the post that goes up today. Entirely up to you. So there we go.
The Wheel of Destiny.
Right. We have to spin the Wheel of Destiny to find out where we're going next week.
The Wheel of Destiny. We are ready for the wheel.
This is where we're going to find out where we're going to go next week, what Emily is going to talk about next week. Yes. What are you thinking? Are you thinking person, event, place? What are you fancying?
I think I'd quite like to talk about a person.
Okay.
I spoke about the Festival of Britain, and I think I spoke about an event before that. So,
you've done quite a lot of events and stuff lately.
Yes, I think I'm going to go for a person. So
I know.
Right, we'll see where the wheel lands. Off we go. Oh, it's... Do you know what? There are a few places on the wheel, Alex, and I have to tell people that we've never been to. You know, we haven't landed on every single...
We haven't. We have switched a couple out when we've... When we've been there quite a few times, haven't we?
But yeah, true. But it's landed in Hyde Park. And if memory serves, we haven't had Hyde Park, have we? Or have we?
I don't know. No, maybe we haven't.
I don't think we have. Oh, this is exciting.
New one. Okay. Wow. Oh, I mean, goodness, there's so much you can talk about there.
Okay, for Hyde Park. I mean, there's been
so many.
You want
a person, don't you? Not an event.
I want a person, yeah. I mean, obviously, it's very well known for its events. There's so many statues and things in there that are connected to people.
There are. You've got J.M. Barrie and Peter Pan and all that kind of thing.
And you've got Speaker's Corner
there. I did him on Global Tea Break there, didn't I?
Oh, you know someone that we mentioned a couple of weeks ago? Oh. Or maybe, did I mention him last week? Jack Shepherd. Oh, it was about the House of Detention.
Jack Shepherd is amazing.
I could talk about Jack Shepherd.
Yes, do Jack Shepherd.
Because I won't say now why, but he has connections to that area. So
yes. Do Jack Shepherd. Yeah, he's amazing.
Okay, yep. All right, let's do that. Jack Shepherd.
Fantastic.
Great. Nice.
Well, there we go. I'm looking forward to that. Oh, he's a bit of a local legend.
Yeah, definitely. Old honest Jack, yeah.
So there we go, that's it for this week.
Cool.
Thank you all so much for coming.
Thank you,
lovely to have you all back. And we will see you next week for a bit of Jack Shepherd loveliness. Don't go Googling him. Don't do it. You're going to love it.
Save it.
Yeah.
And keep hydrated out there, guys, because it is honestly so hot and it's going to continue to be hot until the end of the week, I think. Yeah.
Gosh. Yeah. I'm going to go get in the paddling pool.
Oh, I'm so jelly.
Come over.
Oh, please.
All right, my lovelies. We'll see you next week. Take
care. Take care. Bye.
Bye.